Go home and go to bed. I don't know whether maybe Mr. Franks and I want to enjoy an adult beverage once we get back to the hotel. I'll have to ask him about that, but that might encourage somewhat better sleep. This is not an adult beverage. This is Adam's Ale. Well, we've worked hard on the Sabbath, and tomorrow, the Lord's Day, we will work less hard. We have a shorter day. Tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock we start, as you, I think you know. Mr. Franks has the first couple of hours, and he is presenting on the Sabbatarians. Isn't that correct, Mr. Franks? A two-hour presentation. I've seen it. It's very interesting. So anyway, I hope if you can that you will be here. I may drop Mr. Franks, and then not because I'm not interested in hearing it. I've heard it before, and drive back to the motel and do a little bit more work on my own classes tomorrow morning. And then, of course, we've got a lunch together, and we finish fairly early tomorrow afternoon, so that will give everybody a chance to go home and do what things have to be done before the beginning of the work week Monday morning. This class is the one that I really feel is the center of my presentation. Let me begin with a bit of a question. I wonder how many of you have ever had any contact with the legal system in this country beyond getting a speeding ticket. Which I did fit. Some of you have. Okay. Before I moved up to Cincinnati, Ohio, I worked as a bilingual interpreter in the state courts in the state of Texas, and it was a real eye-opener for me. I enjoyed the work very much. It lasted less than a year, but I liked it and learned a lot, and I got a lot of preaching material from it. The one thing I learned is that something that I had heard prior to that, somebody had told me, we don't have a justice system, we have a legal system. And that may sound trite, but it's true. As I think we all realize, that people who are well-heeled and have lots of money and can hire very expensive lawyers are much more likely to get off the charge than someone who is poor and is not well-connected. In some cases, I went into some of the Texas courts and had to interpret for people who couldn't speak English. In some cases, they were illegal in the country. In virtually every case, they had very little money. And I learned the truth of what we find in the scriptures, that there is no justice in the land. By the time you get to the latter history of Israel and Judah, Isaiah is declaiming on that subject, decrying the fact there's no justice in the land. Jeremiah makes the same point. All of that late history makes the point that the justice system is basically broken down. It's a very it's a very important subject. It's a very sad subject, but we see the same thing in our society today as well. The problem of justice, which is a huge subject. Actually, I keep on thinking of preparing a Feast of Tabernacles sermon on the subject of justice, because God is a God of justice. And one of the great, wonderful to me, one of the most wonderful facets of the description of the world tomorrow, as it's described in the Holy Scriptures, is the fact that God will bring justice to all of humanity in His manner under the rule of Jesus Christ. And I probably need to begin to work on a sermon for next year's Feast of Tabernacles and preach on that subject. But what I'd like to do in this last class is go back into the history and address the subject of justice and look at the problem of justice as it was faced by Moses, the leader of Israel, as Israel formed as a nation. And as they came together, the question of justice came up. Moses was a man of God. Moses is a man who believed in justice, who presumably administered justice, but he was just one man. And you remember the story that he was confronted by his father-in-law in Exodus chapter 18, which is where we're going to begin. And the problem was adjudicating all these legal matters and lawsuits that were coming up within the nation of Israel. Now, if the numbers are correct, and I believe they broadly are, by the time they came out of Egypt, ancient Israel numbered somewhere between 2 and 3 million. Looks to come out at around 2.5 million when you project out the demographics and the reproduction and so on. So this was an enormous nation, and Moses was there trying to adjudicate all of these lawsuits. That he said, she said, he did this against me. And Jethro, his father-in-law, approaches him and says, what are you doing? Now, I think you know the story, but let's read it in Exodus chapter 18. I'm not going to, basically, most of the chapter is about the formation of this judiciary. Exodus 18, beginning around verse 13 here. Jethro was an interesting individual. He figures large in this. And it was so, Exodus 18, verse 13, on the next day, Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood before Moses from morning until evening, presumably from the time the sun came up until the time the sun came down, which could be a little longer or a little shorter, depending on what part of the year it was. So when Moses' father-in-law saw that all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit, and all the people stand before you from morning till evening?" Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws." Interesting, even though all these statutes have not all been laid out in writing at this point, God had communicated them, or was in the process of communicating them to Moses, and Moses understood these principles of justice. Okay, we'll paraphrase a little bit from this point forward. Jethro then says to him, "What are you doing? This is not a good thing. You're going to wear yourself out. You're just one man. You can't be the only judge for 2 or 3 million people." That figure is not used in the text, but apparently that was the number of people that constituted the nation of Israel when they came out. What are you doing? You're going to wear yourself out. You need to select men of character. Verse 21, able men, men who fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place them over the people to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of the people at all times. These qualities of character that Jethro points out are in fact qualities of character that apply in our time, obviously. These are characteristics for leadership in the New Testament church as well. But a pyramid structure goes into place here where there are those who are over thousands, those who are over hundreds, those who are over fifties, and those who are over tens. Not entirely dissimilar from the type of structure that we have in the judiciary in this country, a state structure and the federal structure, where you have a Supreme Court. And Moses became the Supreme Court, so to speak, and he got a very narrowed brief, a narrowed list of cases that he had to hear, but they were the most difficult ones that he had to hear, and the easier ones were then passed down the line to these lower levels in the structure. All right, what I'd like to do in the remainder of the class is look at some of these things that had to be judged. Because, as I mentioned before, I believe we in the Church of God understand fairly clearly when we read the laws that are Levitical. We understand these things we don't have to do in the church today because there is no functioning Levitical priesthood. That's fairly easy, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. However, when we read the laws that were given, that were in fact instructions to the judges, I think sometimes we can overlook the implications of the fact that much of what we could begin to read from Exodus 21 forward is in fact instructions for the judges. So much of what we term the law of Moses constitutes is framed in terms of instructions for judges. Let me show you a few examples. Exodus chapter 21, verses 8 through 11. Exodus 21, verses 8 through 11. Let's begin in verse 7. "If a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she doesn't please her master, who's betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since she has dealt deceitfully with her. And if he has betrothed her to his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. If he doesn't do these three things for her, then she shall go out free without paying money." Now, when we read a law like this, it highlights a couple of things that we have to understand when we look at all this body of law. Number one, and I'm not going to cover this in a great deal of detail, but number one, that marriage was a very different institution back then. And when you read the laws governing marriage, what was within the purview of a lot of this was protection, actually. Protection of the woman and protection of the man's interests, which was very often to make sure that there was somebody to continue the family name. Marriage was a very different institution. There's that cultural aspect to it. But there's something else here as well. And that is the question of who does this? If he doesn't do these three things for her, then she goes out free. How was it determined that he had not done these three things for her, viz., food, clothing, and marriage rites, sex, in other words? If he didn't do those three things, she goes out free. Obviously, somebody had to adjudicate whether or not he had done those things for her. And the implication in this law is that there was some kind of system. It was something that belonged in the realm of the judiciary. Exodus 21, verses 18 and 19. Exodus 21, verses 18 and 19. If men contend with each other, and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he doesn't die, but he's confined to his bed, if he rises again and he walks about outside with his staff, then he who struck him shall be acquitted. He shall only pay for the loss of his time, and he shall provide for him to be thoroughly healed. So, somebody is wounded. He's bedridden for a while. He gets up. He walks about with a stick. And the one who struck him is acquitted in terms of any other punishment. And then he pays for the loss of time. He reimburses him because this man has lost earnings. And then he has to also reimburse him for his medical expenses. Again, this raises the question of how was this done back in ancient Israel? How should it have been done? Because obviously through most of Israel's history, it was not done or was not done properly. But had it been done properly, this was something that was to be at the level of the judges. The judges would have been the ones who would have determined, presumably in some kind of a hearing, that he was confined to his bed, but that he didn't die, and that the level of physical harm rose only to a certain level, and this, therefore the person who'd done this had to reimburse him for his medical expenses and for loss of earnings. This was something that was at the level of the judges. The judiciary did this kind of thing. Now, what do we learn from a law like this? We learn that if somebody wounds somebody and therefore prevents them from earning a living for a space of time, that this is wrong. This is, it's a law that defines sin, is it not? But within the structure of the church, we would not enact the same law. We would not enact it in the same way. We wouldn't fine somebody. We wouldn't bring it before the elders or the pastors and say, and then the elder or the pastor have the legal right to say this person has to pay a fine. That would be something that would lie at the level of federal law or perhaps of state law. It doesn't lie within the bailiwick of the church. Exodus 21, verses 12 and 13. Exodus 21, verses 12 and 13. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. However, if he doesn't lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, I'm going to appoint you a place where he may flee. These were the cities of refuge, explained in detail a good bit later. Now, interesting, what we get here is a distinction we have in our law, the law of the land, the distinction between murder and manslaughter. And I think you know sometimes people go into court and they succeed in plea bargaining. They plead it down in order to get greater leniency. They sort of bend the definition a little bit, and somebody who may actually be guilty of murder gets a charge of manslaughter instead of murder. What do we learn from this? Number one, we learn that to strike a man so that he dies is sin in God's sight, obviously. Somebody strikes someone, whether it's premeditated or not, it's sin in God's sight. Then we learn that he's to be put to death. Who put him to death? Again, this is something that, within the context of ancient Israel, lay within the responsibility of the judiciary. They had to determine, verse 13, whether or not he had lain in wait. Was it murder or was it manslaughter? Again, this was the prerogative of the judiciary. And we see here, once again, that we've got a law that, on the one hand, the action that God prohibited is a sinful action. It remains a sinful action for us in New Testament, New Covenant times. But the way in which the punishment was carried out is not the same in the church today. We would not enact places of refuge for somebody guilty of manslaughter. In fact, the whole law pertaining to manslaughter and murder is not something that belongs within the church. It belongs with the law of the land. What if we had somebody who was a murderer in the church? Well, we'll get to that question a little bit later. Exodus 21, verses 22 through 24. Let's look at another example. Exodus 21, 22 through 24. If men fight and hurt a woman with child, so she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, she is to be punished as the woman's husband imposes, and he shall pay as the judges determine. Notice in verse 22, it mentions the judges. There was some kind of hearing. Is it sin to fight and then hurt a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely? Yes, of course it is. Of course it is. Does the definition of sin remain the same for us today? Yes, of course we do. Would we deal with it in the same way? Again, the answer is no, because this isn't something that would normally be within the realm of the church. It's something, it's a responsibility that lies at the level of the law of the land. Verse 23, if any harm follows, you give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe, the famous lex talionis. Again, these are instructions for the judges in ancient Israel. When physical harm occurs, then you enact corporal punishment with a cap on it, up to a certain level and not beyond. These things define what was objectionable to God. But do they apply in the church? Not really, because when these things happen, then the responsibility for this kind of crime and punishment lies at the level of the law of the land. Exodus 22, verses 16 and 17. Exodus 22, verses 16 and 17. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall surely pay the bride price for her to be his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money according to the bride price of virgins. Now again, we see marriage as a very different institution back then. People's interest in getting married was different. It was much more practical. It was less romantic. But again, we see a law here which is designed to provide some level of protection. But who enacted it? Again, a judiciary in ancient Israel were the ones who would have enacted this kind of law to make sure that the young woman had a certain level of protection. It's the purpose of the law. Okay, let me give a couple of technical terms which will describe many of these laws that we read in the laws of Moses. They are apoditic laws, A-P-O-D-I-C-T-I-C, apoditic. They have a protosis and they have an apodosis. If A, then B. You've read a lot of them, haven't you? If this happens, then this is what you're supposed to do. If A, then B. And when we read these apoditic laws, what we're usually reading is instructions to the judges. If this happens, then you do this. It's directed to the judges in ancient Israel. As we read these laws, as I mentioned in a previous class, we look at them all according to their intent and purpose. In some cases, it is hard because you have to kind of project yourself back thousands of years to the time of Moses and look at marriage, for example, which was a different institution. But we look at it all according to its intent. Why did God give this? Usually, what's forbidden and what's not allowed under this kind of apoditic law defines sin. Don't do this. And if it happens in the community, then this is the punishment that you enact. The first clause usually defines what is not permitted. What was defined as sin back then and remains sin in New Covenant times. And the second part is the action to be taken by the judiciary within ancient Israel. Penalties. What kind of penalties were enacted under the system of crime and punishment in ancient Israel? Number one, capital punishment. Exodus chapter 21, verse 17. Some of these are easier examples. Exodus 21, verse 17. He who curses his father or mother. Let's stop there. Is it sin for someone who doesn't live under the Mosaic administration, for someone who is a member of the church, or for that matter, somebody who's not even a converted Christian? Is it sin to curse your father or your mother? Yes, obviously. Sometimes I don't like watching these afternoon TV programs when everyone's screaming at each other, but every now and then they get these people on TV and you've got some teenager screaming at her mom and cursing her mom, and they come on TV and the mother says, "My daughter keeps on cursing me," and I think to myself, that's forbidden in the scripture. Is it sin to curse your father or your mother? Obviously, it ties together with the commandment that says we're to honor our father and our mother. Shall surely be put to death. Who put them to death? It assumes some kind of hearing. It assumes some kind of judicial action within the context of ancient Israel. Is that law in effect? Yes and no. It still defines sin. But the death penalty that God prescribed for ancient Israel is something that God will hold national and state governments responsible for. We don't enact the death penalty within the church. What would we do, by the way, if this took place within the church? What would we do? I haven't known it ever. Maybe it has happened. I don't know. But if a teenager came to church and during church began spitting out invective and maybe even cursing against his or her father or mother, well, I think the answer is obvious. We would probably say, you know, if you're sorry, but if you can't keep your child under control, I'm really sorry, but I think you're going to have to stay home. We can't have this happening in church services. My point is very simple, that about the only form of discipline, significant disciplinary measure that we have in the church is to tell people to stay home, or in some cases to disfellowship people. Corporal punishment, capital punishment, and then corporal punishment. Exodus 21, verse 23. Exodus 21, verse 23. But if any harm follows, give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. There was corporal punishment back in ancient Israel that God instructed the judges to carry out. Again, it always assumed some kind of hearing. Came before the judges. Did this, in fact, happen? And then had it been done properly, there would have been corporal punishment. Again, we don't whip people in the church. Maybe there are times that we think we should, but we don't do that. Fines. Exodus 21, verse 22. Exodus 21, verse 22. If men fight and hurt a woman with child so she gives birth prematurely, yet no harm follows, he shall surely be punished according as the woman's husband imposes on him. He shall pay as the judges determine. Again, a system of fines was there for sins that were not as grievous as the ones that brought capital punishment or the ones that brought corporal punishment, but in some cases the judges could fine people. Now, when we read all of these laws, we have to ask ourselves the question, not so much how did it work in ancient Israel, but do these laws still define sin? And the answer to the question, in most cases when we look at the intent, the answer is still going to be yes. These laws still define sin. We look at these laws of Moses, and these are things that are not permitted for us to do today. The way in the mechanism took place was different, but these things still define sin. Finally, restitution, Exodus 22 and verse 5. Exodus 22 and verse 5. If a man causes a field or a vineyard to be grazed and lets loose his animal and it feeds in another man's field, well, what if, you know, what if you did that by mistake and your cow went and fed in someone else's field? Probably most of us would have enough of a conscience problem. We'd probably knock on the door of our neighbor and say, you know, I'm really sorry, but my cow came and started munching your grass, and can I reimburse you for your grass? But a restitution was involved here. He shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. We have in the system of penalties and punishments for ancient Israel capital punishment, corporal punishment, fines, and restitution, those four things. We really are not called on to put any of those punishments into effect in the church today. And yet, when we look at the first part of the law, it still tells us something. The fact that God prohibited the action in ancient Israel and said to ancient Israel, have the judges adjudicate this matter and then punish for it being done, tells us that it was objectionable to God for a good reason, and it still is objectionable to God in our modern day. The protosis, yes. The apodosis, no. Exodus 22, verse 21. Exodus 22, no, let's look at verse 28. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned. Its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be acquitted. Now, I talked about that one before. Seems strange. It seems arcane, talking about oxen. What does this have to do with us today? And again, it's framed as an instruction for the judges. The flesh is not to be eaten, the ox is stoned, and the owner of the ox is acquitted. All right. Doesn't have a direct application for us today, but it tells us something. What's the intent of this law? If you had oxen back then and you didn't control them, you were responsible. God expects us to control anything, any animals that we may have. If we happen to own a chow or a pit bull, we better keep that under control. All of these instructions from God through Moses teach us something. They all give us instructions about situations, new situations that might arise in our own lives. Let's take a look. Some of the laws in the Old Testament are in fact framed as case law. Something came up in the book of Numbers. Let's move out of the book of Exodus now. Let's go to the book of Numbers, where a situation came up where there was a family. The family was composed in the second generation only of single women. They had not married. They were concerned about the situation. Since they were unmarried women and they didn't know whether they were ever going to be married, the question of inheritance came up. In Numbers chapter 27, Numbers 27, interesting story here of the daughters of Zelophehad. Numbers 27, verses 1 through 11. Then came the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, son of Manasseh, from the families of Manasseh. They were the tribe of Manasseh, the half-tribe. And their names were Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. Isn't that an interesting sequence of names? And they stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, before the leaders and all the congregation, by the doorway of the tabernacle of meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord, in company with Korah, but he died in his own sin. He had no sons. Why should the name of our father be removed from among his family? Because he had no son. Give us a possession among our father's brothers." Now, it was a patriarchal society back then. They were unmarried, and they come to Moses, and they present something which comes up then as case law. This has never come up before. What are we to do? Moses didn't have the answer. He took it to God. Verse 5. Moses brought their case before the Lord, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "The daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers, and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them. And you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, 'If a man dies and has no son, then cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter. If he has no daughter, you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father has no brothers, give his inheritance to the relative closest to him in the family, and he shall possess it. And it shall be to the children of Israel a statute of judgment, just as the Lord commanded Moses.'" A new law, case law. What do we learn from this? We learn, obviously, that God is concerned about the women who may be unmarried, that they should be provided for. There's a broad principle here, but some of these things come up then as case law. In Numbers chapter 36, this is the daughters of Zelophehad part 2. We won't take the time to read all the way through, but then they come back to Moses and they say, "Now what if we want to get married? Whom should we marry? We've inherited, but if we marry someone who doesn't belong to the tribe of Manasseh, then what happens?" And the case law that comes down in this instance, and again, it would not apply in the same way in the church today, was that they had to be had to marry within the same tribe, so the land would not go out of the tribe. A principle: God doesn't want anyone left high and dry. That includes single women. You see, when we read all these things, I think we can see, yeah, okay, much of this applies to ancient Israel, much of this addresses situations that may not come up in the modern world, and much of it is instruction for the judges, but we see echoes and repercussions and principles that tell us about God's will, about his intent, about the reason why he gave some of these laws. The ox accustomed to goring. God doesn't want people to be maimed by machine tools or auto vehicles. What was objectionable to God is expressed then through Moses. Deuteronomy chapter 19. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 19. Deuteronomy 19. Verses 15 through 21, the law concerning witnesses. Again, this is instructions for what was to take place in a judicial setting in ancient Israel. Deuteronomy 19, verse 15. One witness shall not rise against a man concerning any iniquity or any sin that he commits. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. It's instructions for the judges once again, isn't it? We don't have a judiciary, not in the same way in the church. Sometimes ministers are called on to adjudicate matters, but it's different because it's not part of a national structure. But what does this tell us? It tells us when someone is accused of something, if the accusation comes from one person, don't give it a lot of credence. Two or three witnesses, why? So someone's reputation can be protected. What does the law tell us? It tells us that God is concerned that people's reputations would not be torn down by one other human being who may simply have a resentment against the person. Verse 16, if a false witness rises against any man to testify against him of wrongdoing, then both men in the controversy shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who serve in those days. Notice once again, it's these two groups of people that function within ancient Israel. And the judges shall make careful inquiry. Again, we've got a hearing. Look into this. Instructions for the judges. And indeed, if the witness is a false witness who's testified falsely against his brother, then you shall do to him as he thought to have done to his brother, so you shall put away the evil from among you. False accusation comes back on the shoulders of the person who brought the false accusation. Now, within the church, of course, at times we have to investigate things to find out whether the accusation is true or false. But we don't enact this kind of penalty in exactly the same way. What do we learn from this law? God is concerned for people's reputations. God doesn't want someone's name sullied on the basis of one witness. God wants us to be sure before we deal in hearsay or gossip, things that sometimes even go around the church. We need to be very careful about those things. There are times when we all get asked, well, what have you heard about this? And we should be careful, by the way, not to pass on hearsay. Well, you know, I think this is what, because I've heard somebody said this is what's going on. Or I've heard somebody said that so-and-so is doing this particular thing. God doesn't base decisions on hearsay. He doesn't base decisions on one witness. Verse 20, those who remain shall hear and fear, and hereafter you shall not again commit such evil among you. It was evil then. It's evil now. Your eye shall not pity, life shall be for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. So it's an instruction for the judges, but it tells us a principle that is an eternal principle, and it defines what's right and wrong. Now this principle, interestingly enough, shows up in the New Testament, doesn't it? This principle of protection of people's reputations and avoiding gossip and hearsay is applied by the Apostle Paul in 1 Timothy 5 and verse 19. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 19. Paul applies it as he's teaching the young evangelist Timothy how to run the church, basically. And he doesn't say stone people for false witness, but he does warn him, don't receive false witness. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 19. Don't receive an accusation against an elder except from two or three witnesses. Where did Paul get that answer? Straight out of the book of Deuteronomy, obviously. Did he understand that there was a principle here involving sin, involving righteousness? Yes, he did. Did Paul pick and choose? Did he? I think the Apostle Paul could have been accused unjustly of picking and choosing, just as we have been from time to time. But he understood when he looked back at that principle in the book of Deuteronomy, especially within the church, and especially with regard to the reputation of an elder in the church, it was not sufficient to have one witness. It was important to have a minimum of two, and ideally three, before any action was taken against an elder in the church. Did Paul pick and choose? I find it interesting to do a study on how many times the Apostle Paul sought justification for his own actions within the church, and he goes back to the law. I'd like to give you one other example this evening, in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, It's an interesting example here. Because you remember in 1 Corinthians 5, Paul had to deal with a very serious problem in the church, a problem of immorality. There was a man living with his stepmother. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, let's pick it up at the beginning of the chapter, because the beginning of the chapter is interesting as well. It's actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and such sexual immorality as is not named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife. Well, you could say it was self-evident that it was wrong for that to take place. But no doubt Paul went back to the law, to Leviticus 18, verses 6 through 8, where exactly that behavior is prohibited. There's a list of prohibited relationships back in chapter 18, and it was on the basis of that list of relationships that the Apostle Paul said, we can't have that in the church. Question, would any of the other forbidden relationships in Leviticus 18 have been tolerated, other than the incestuous relationship with the stepmother? Answer, no. They all remain forbidden, even into New Testament times. And Paul took action. But when you get to the end of the chapter and he chides the church for tolerating it, and he chides and corrects the church for putting up with it, verse 9, I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people, and he got the definition out of the book of Leviticus, no doubt. And then verses 12 and 13, and this is the detail that I find very interesting. For what have I to do with judging those also who are outside? Don't you judge those who are inside? Verse 13, but those who are outside God judges. Therefore, put away from yourselves the evil person. You ever trace down that quote? Your margin probably gives it to you. It's all the way through the book of Deuteronomy. Paul is quoting straight out of the book of Deuteronomy for his action in putting this man out of the church. So did Paul pick and choose? Did he? Or did he, on the other hand, read the entire law and see what was objectionable to God and at times take action on the basis of some of those things that were written in the law of Moses? I submit the latter. What do we do then when we read all of these laws and we see certain things were forbidden? Sometimes there was a fine. Sometimes there was corporal punishment. In very severe cases, there was capital punishment. We look at all of it according to its intent and its purpose, and we apply it where we're able to apply it. We look at it all, and we analyze whether it defines something that was objectionable to God back then and remains objectionable to God through all times in all the covenant-type relationships. One last thought before we finish this for this evening. We read many of these things back in under the law of Moses, and we read that in some cases there was even up to capital punishment. We don't execute people. It's not our responsibility to carry out capital punishment in the church today. But I wonder whether we realize that we actually have people, brothers and sisters, who can't normally fellowship with us, who can't normally come to church. They're behind bars for having supposedly committed some of these crimes. The law of the land still holds them responsible. In some cases, those people have repented of their sins. God has forgiven them. Christ has forgiven them. That responsibility that under the Mosaic covenant lay with the government in ancient Israel is being carried out by the law of the land, and they don't get off the hook. But in God's sight, they do get off the hook. We look back at all of those laws, and we look at the intent of those laws, and ask ourselves, what does it tell us? What does it tell me as an individual? What does it tell us about the way the church should do things? And most importantly, what does it tell us about what was objectionable to God and what was pleasing in God's sight? It's a more complicated picture, isn't it, than simply to say the Ten Commandments are in force and the rest is gone. But it gives us a more accurate impression of what is right and just and what's wrong in God's sight all the way down through the ages. Okay, I'll leave it there for the evening.